Joshua Schenck is an author of books such as Lincoln's Melancholy and Powers of Two, Finding the Essence of Innovation in Creative Pairs. This is Joshua Schenck. I'm Duncan Gammy. You're listening to Dunk Tank. All right. I'm here with Josh Schenck. Thank you very much for joining me today.
My pleasure.
I had read your book, Powers of Two, which is all about these creative pairs and how a lot of great contributions to art and science have come out of pair relationships, and that your sort of thesis of the book is that those pair relationships have really been undervalued, but also that, and you even say this in the title, that they form like the essence of innovation. I get the fact that they've been undervalued on some level, but why do you think that, like, pairs in particular are what drives creative leaps forward?
I'm glad to tackle that and to kind of take you into the heart of the book as I see it. It also involves a slight revision. Your summation of the book, I think, is quite appropriate, given the way what the text of the book and the way it was marketed and received. There is some daylight between that and what my real intention was and is.
Interesting. Okay.
I'll tell you briefly that I began the book with a curiosity in this thing we call chemistry between two people. What is it that enlivens the space between two people in a way that leads to something greater than could be done on one's own? And I began to study those instances of creativity in pair relationships. And I had the idea that there was a really useful unit of study because it's the smallest possible social unit. It's the least. It's the most straightforward. It's the smallest sample that you could put under a microscope, so to speak, and study the social element that so animates humanity. So that then led to, okay, well, if I'm using that as my method, my editor believed, and I gladly followed, that unit of study also needed to be privileged. Privilege is not the right word. It needed to be asserted really, potently. I really needed to claim the pair as, underappreciated, and I needed to distinguish between the pair and the group, and the pair and the triad, and so on. If I were to write the book again, if I were to take what you've read as a draft and do another draft, I would do away with a lot of the primacy of pair stuff. I really would.
Mm. Why do you say that?
Title, because I think the book was misread, and I don't say that with because I'm bitter at anyone who's done a misreading. I think the book set itself up to be misread as being about creative pairs, when creative pairs was a means to understand chemistry, creative intimacy, and the way that we are actually, we're bound up in something that is way beyond any easy conception of the individual. The working title for the book for years, which I not only wish I had used, I sometimes dream about rewriting the book and giving it this title, kind of writing a book about a response to my earlier book, and giving it the title "How to Explode." And I love that phrase because it suggests how to get big, how to get whatever, how to be creatively successful, whatever. but also the explosion of the ego, the explosion of the conception of being an individual, which I think is part of the creative journey for most people, one way or another. Most creative experiences lead that way. And look, I mean, here we are having this conversation at a time when it's never been more clear how we're interrelated and how, you know, yes, we're individuals, but it's really more illusion than substance. And the illusion, I think, is nicely, the nice metaphor for it is the aspen tree, where you have what seem like distinct trees. They look like, oh, that's an aspen tree, that's another aspen tree. They're distinct shoots out of the ground, but they're part of this. They have the same root system. They're really distinct expressions of a larger individual. And I do believe that. I think the pair stuff, yes, pairs are incredibly important. Pairs are very useful. There's also a lot of meaningful stuff happens in triads. I'm extremely interested in what happens in groups and teams. You know, it's not like the pair is more important than the... It's just, at the time I wrote the book, I really thought it was a way into something special. And then, I don't know, I think a little bit of the pop psychology, book marketing thinking took over that, you know, we were going to assert something that, you know, gave the book, you know, an extra bit of distinction in this kind of you know, marketplace of books about the social experience. And I think that backfired.
Okay. So there are two things that I'm thinking of as you were saying all that. The first thing, just to address like your main point about the fact that we're not really individuals. And I like that metaphor of the trees because, you know, like trees are, there have been lots of studies that have come out recently about trees. They communicate in ways that are so strange. Like they take stumps, they keep them alive by sending them nutrients. Like why would they do that? You know, there clearly is some sort of group element there, and we're definitely different with different people. Like, you know, I'm a different person with my parents than I am with my best friend from middle school than I am with my brother. And it's not like I'm wearing a mask in those different social situations. It like a different part of me gets activated. Right. And I think that that's, you know, whether it's pairs, groups, whatever it is, it's a really fascinating topic. And the second thing I was going to say was about the publishing marketing sort of bullshit that you had to go through, and I imagine that was like part of it was the publisher, maybe part of it is, you know, I don't know, I don't want to assign blame or anything like that, but clearly,
yeah, nor do I. And I want to jump in and say the first thing you said is just totally on point. That actually is exactly where I started. Like, just a pure and naive fascination and like, what is going on when I'm around these different people? Like what is that about? That's what I wanted to study. I actually am just as interested as when things are shitty, when things feel inauthentic, when it's not quite right, or maybe it's like, you know, a C+ or a B-. Like I'm interested in all of those different ways that people affect each other. I decided for this book that it would be an interesting thing to focus on the sublime experiences, not for happiness or subjective well-being, but for creative output. So I made that decision. But I also want to jump in on the publishing stuff and say and I don't mean to criticize you in the way you just framed it, but just to say, right. That was the system of relationship I engaged with that all published authors have to engage with one way or another, and it was Look, if I write How to Explode, which I have notes for, I once in a peek wrote the introduction for it. This would actually be the story, how writing a book about, you know, social engagement, creativity, I was enmeshed in these relationships that were quite hot. I mean, they were hot in the sense of they were just, it was energized. There was conflict. There was a sense of great rapport. And I, in the end, think that, I'll just say, I think that we failed.
Wow.
I do. And I think, to the extent that you're interested, to the extent you and I can have this conversation, that's wonderful. I think the ideas in the book are better than the way they were received. And I think that I did something wrong, actually, that's very much a subject for the book.
Okay, so here's what I was going to say. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah. No. Well, I'll just finish this thought and say, I think I actually became so enamored at what could pass between me and my editor that I neglected to really rock back on the heels of something that needed to be underneath that. And that itself is part of navigating one of these relationships. It's a constant. You have to do both all the time, but the balance has to be just right. And the balance was pretty good in this book. I mean, we published a book. It got out. The failure is probably too strong, but it.
Oh man, it's not. Something off. I'm sorry, but it's not. It's definitely not a failure. Like, that's a really strong word for a book. Like, you spend, I don't know how long you spent, but a book is a substantial commitment. Like, this was not. This is not a waste of effort.
It's just, yes, but I don't know, man. It's like, you know,
it's not what you wanted it to be.
It's not what I wanted to be. And sometimes just putting things in bold ways are helpful because it's helpful to be even crude about it and blunt to a fault because it allows you to just put up, you know, to really emphasize something. So yeah, look, sometimes a painter goes in the studio and they just come out with something that's, it's not as good as it could have been. That's how I feel about this book.
Yeah. That's okay. So this book. The thing I wanted to ask you about then is,
yes,
why don't you just write this book, How to Explode? And, but hang on. Cause I was literally like a couple hours ago, I was just on the phone with one of my friends and I was like, why isn't it that authors, like, why is it that musicians still have to sync up with these record companies and authors still have to sync up with publishers when you have an electronic means of distribution? Like, you can...
Yes, this is interesting, yes.
Because, I don't know how much... You make per book sold, and you don't have to. If you had an easily available link on your website where it's like, okay, you can download the file for my book, and you can download the file that is for, you know, the Amazon Kindle, the file that's for the the Apple iBook, and so on, You can donate however much you want, as little as a penny. And now that sounds really small, but most people, like, they've done this with other, you know, software and stuff like that. Most people don't donate a penny. They'll donate like $5, which is, I would guess, more than the average author makes per book sold. Maybe there's like some like upfront money that goes into the deal, but
yeah, that's
overall
more.
Like that's yeah, more. Yeah, 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 yeah. But, like, you don't.
Okay, well, I see your point. And so let's talk about this because I think it's really interesting. I think it's really interesting. And definitely, you know, apt for this moment.
Yeah.
I guess if I was on tour in 2014, because, you know, I went on tour and I stayed pretty on message. I really wanted to articulate the value of this book for, you know, public conversation. So the on-message answer I would give to that question is that this is a classic example of lone genius thinking, that an author can simply create and disseminate, when in fact, what happens when you go into a bookstore that you like, whether it's, you know, an independent bookstore or Barnes & Noble, or even if you go on Amazon and you see a book there and it piques your interest, what has happened is a vastly complex thing that most people never learn the first thing about. And in the same way that most people don't learn the first thing about nuclear engineering, I mean, it's a an all manner of craft and professional ecosystem. And what's happening, what happens when you hold a book in your hand and it and you get to feel like, oh, you're just having this lovely conversation with an author, has been shaped by an enormous number of social systems. And there are exceptions, but they are very, very, very rare. They're shockingly rare. And when you do see things disseminated from an artist to an audience directly, an overwhelming number of times, that artist has already been shaped by the system and has been, has gotten to a place with the system where they have the capacity to replicate that social system privately, or, you know, on their own, and to own it, to own the means of production or whatever. But right. Most authors don't. Not even Stephen King does it. And you could go to Stephen King and say, why don't you do this, man? Like, why are you working with an agent? You're Stephen King.
Yeah.
And he'd say, oh, well, look at all the things they do for me. Like, yeah, I could hire all these people and run a little publishing company, but I actually want to write. I want to put words on the paper, and I make plenty, and I get the, you know, movie deals, and, you know, I do the speaking gigs, and I do fine.
Yeah.
And I'm enmeshed in this circle of, you know, of colleagues. And a lot of what I'm saying in the book, and this is the on-message answer, is most for most people, those systems are hidden by design. Agents don't want to be public. Editors don't want to be public. They need to put the author out front. In the same way that when you go to a rock concert, you don't see the roadies. You don't see the engineers who designed the sound system. You just see Axl Rose and you're happy. Great, okay? But the problem is, you're a little kid, you grew up wanting to be Axl Rose, and you have this illusion, this truly dangerous illusion, that if you just had the charisma, if you just had the gumption, if you just had the talent, you could be up there. And you don't know about the social systems, the professional systems that person is one shoot of, like the aspen tree. He's just one shoot of this big system up there. And this becomes very harmful. And the people who are, by and large, exempted from that harm are people who already know something. It's the insider problem. If you grow up in Manhattan or in Silver Lake or in certain neighborhoods of San Francisco or Portland, you're going to know a literary agent. You're going to know what a music producer does. But if you don't know those people and you don't get that implicit education, well, you're really, by this culture, you're really left out on your own, because the magazines aren't going to tell you. The big self-help books aren't going to tell you. They're all full of pap, like, you know, just take yourself on a creative date. They don't tell you how to work those networks and how to, you know, it's an enormous amount of work. And if you take any group of professional creative people out for drinks and get them talking, this is what they're going to talk about. So in my crowd of writers, like, who's your agent? What's going on with that thing? Oh, you went with the good indie press. What about that commercial press? Those guys are doing pretty good work. Though, did he leave there? Oh yeah, I heard that he retired, but he came back. It's like people are trading this very important knowledge,
right?
That is the ambient kind of that, you know, makes up the landscape of this professional environment. That's my on message.
Okay.
So I got distracted from what I was going to say next.
No.
I was
going
to say something next.
That's fine.
You jump in.
I get, okay. So I get what you're saying. Now, a couple of things. First off, you have...
Wait, Duncan, I'm sorry. Okay. I remembered, and I just really want to say this last thing. And then I really want to hear what you have to say, too.
Please, yes.
I also am someone who... I am a very particular kind of person who needs to be in creative relationship. There's certain things I do really, really well, and there's certain things I'm terrible at. One thing I do very, very well is I'm very good at generating ideas. And to be, you know, I can compliment myself. I think I generate really, really good ideas at a very high volume. But I'm very poor at discriminating among those ideas and deciding and prioritizing. And that is why I need a lot of help. And you can, as I said about the Stephen King example, like, yeah, you could construct that help, but that's not really how the world works. You don't go around and like build your own publishing enterprise.
Well, but hang on.
With the publishing enterprise as it existed, as it exists.
But here's the thing. Okay, so this is what I was going to say, is that the best analogy that I can think of, or the best example of an industry where this has really changed, is comedy. Okay, so it used to be that comedians had to fight, and like tooth and nail, for a few HBO stand-up special spots. Now, a lot of them are making their own specials. They get their own team together. They film it themselves.
Like who?
Louis C.K. before he, you know, did his thing. Joe Rogan.
No. Louis C.K., no. He was already super famous.
Oh, au contraire.
He had famous when he did his
But hang on. I'll give you an even better example then. Okay. Of someone, Andrew Schultz, who's a younger comic, and he tried to take his stand-up specials to Netflix. He had filmed them himself, and they turned it down, and he wound up chopping it up into 5-10 minute segments on YouTube. They got millions of hits.
Yeah.
And then he was on the Joe Rogan podcast, which is the most popular podcast in the world. And he's now, you know, selling out theaters. Like, this, that helped him get to the next level. Well, what I'm saying is, you're not necessarily doing this on your own. That doesn't mean you have to. And look, I'm not in the book publishing world, so obviously you know this better than I do. But it seems like there is an opportunity for somebody smart to do something different. And
okay,
I think once someone does it, they'll look back and say, we should have done it. Sorry, go ahead.
I'm sorry, you finished. That was impolite of me.
No, it's
time to do something different, and
that's it. I was saying once somebody does that, people will look back and go, "Wow, that was something people should have done earlier."
Okay, sure, absolutely. Technology changes means the distribution changes, businesses change, 100%. And I don't know. I do know the story of Lucy K. I don't know the story of this other comic you mentioned, but I'm sure it is a very interesting story and important. 100%. But it's another version of a relationship story. It's not like, oh, we don't need the relationship anymore. It's another version of it.
Mm.
And it, and in itself, it's ancient. Now, when Walt Whitman was read by Emerson, and Emerson, I greet you at the beginning of a promising career, he had also done something super indie that he then was able to present to people, and it got taken up in that presentation, and he became bound up in a larger world. I mean, he essentially self-published, not essentially, he did self-publish Leaves of Grass. He did a lot of other super indie stuff. I mean, you know, he not only self-published it, and then he wrote all those reviews of it under pseudonyms. I mean, he was a total creative gorilla, that guy. So, and in all times and all situations, some aspect of that, it not only, you know, it's not only exciting when it happens, it has to happen. There has to be some moment of preparation before you have anything to offer anybody else. You know, you don't. When Paul McCartney met John Lennon, he wasn't like, oh, well, show me what the E string is. Man, that guy could play a lick. He impressed the hell out of John Lennon. And Lennon impressed the hell out of McCartney. They had something to bring to each other. And then they get bound up. My problem is when the story is told that eliminates the social element. But it's also problematic in the opposite extreme when you emphasize the social element that, you know, the content of solitude and its essential role. And in the end, this is an extremely dichotomous process. It's not a unilateral thing. The problem is that we have brains that are constantly seeking unilateral truths. Our brains are just built that way. So our brains want to say, you know, screw the system, do it on your own. In fact, those are two sides of things that have to live together and always do in meaningful creative lives. In a meaningful creative life, there's always part working in a system and part bucking it. You always see those things together. And yeah, actually, it might be like what you just said. Yeah, just write this thing, put it on your website. See if people pay you a penny or $5 for it. Maybe I should. I've already got a couple thousand words. Maybe I should write another 8 or 15,000 and just try it as an experiment. And I might.
Yeah. I mean, I think I don't necessarily see the harm of it unless there's an opportunity cost of time better spent.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, it's all, I mean, that's, you know, where's your time best spent? Right now, I'm actually trying to finish a manuscript that I've been working on for years. And so that's, yeah, right now I'm in the phase where I'm trying to lash myself to the mast, you know, say, no, you know, don't do it. No, don't pursue that other idea. Don't do that other thing. Just get this one done.
How does this one feel?
You know, this is the follow of my experience with what was called Powers of Two. I never even liked that title, to be honest. So far from publishing the book that I can just be totally honest, I never liked the title. Hated the subtitle of the hardcover. Published that book, and then about a year and a half later, I got the following spring. I was interviewed and got a really nice day job with a good salary. And I thought, you know, I'm going to use this moment where I don't need to earn a living through my writing to just try, see what it would feel like to write a book without asking an agent first. Just write something that really feels important to me. And for better and for worse, that's what I've been doing for 5 years. And it's actually funny because I was just finished writing before we talked, and the book includes a kind of meta element telling this, talking about the years in which I wrote the book. And yeah, it was pretty out in the wilderness. I am still pretty out in the wilderness with this book. And it is an experiment to see, you know, what happens when I write a book that's not under contract and where, you know, I haven't made any, you know, professional promises around it. And the only question is, you know, what feels true and real to me, and what do I think will reach a reader? And that it has had some advantages, but there are also acute disadvantages of doing it this way. So I've been in the midst of that.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like you're kind of getting back to the soil almost. Like there's got to be
trying.
Yeah, it's got to be a little scary, I imagine, when it's not already all lined up and you know it's going out and being published and guaranteed.
Well, the main thing. No, that's not. Yeah, there's that's an element of it. But even when a editor tells you, "Hey, I'm going to do this piece," there's a part of you that doesn't think it's real. The harder part is much more mundane. The harder part is not having a deadline. It's not having someone call you up and say, "Hey, you know, April 1st," and you know, tap their calendar, and you know, and send you an email March 15th and say, "Hey, man, 2 more weeks. You know, how's it going?"
Yeah.
You know, there's if you look at creative people, you'll see a billion, you know, epigraphic remarks about that are some version of, you know, it's not finished, you know, I never finish something. I just surrender. I just give up, you know, you give up to the deadline. I'm fascinated this with visual artists. I know a fair number of visual artists, and for them, the big deadline is a show and like the shipping date for a show. And over again, you just see these arduous physical feats, you know, 10, 12, 14, 18 hours a day. And they're not, you know, they're done when the FedEx truck comes.
Yeah.
You know, or an hour before when they have to crate it up. So that's a lot of what, you know, that's a lot of what happens in a system are these pretty mundane acts of, you know, of checks.
Well, but do you have like a routine? Like, okay, I write at this time every day for this much time, or I need to get this many, you know, topics done, or however you divide it up.
I always have routine on my mind. I don't necessarily always abide by one. I actually have been in a good routine for the last couple of weeks. Weirdly, you know, I feel guilty for appreciating any aspect of this calamity, but it has actually been helpful for my writing, being at home and the way I'm at home and not traveling, and that has definitely been helpful for routine. And it's been quite pleasurable actually. In the last week or so, I've been writing until 1, it's actually quite helpful to have a hard cutoff. To just know that, like, you know, yeah, that there's just a moment when it's going to end, and so I'm booked up the rest of the day and night with obligations.
In terms of like your writing life, I know we're getting a little away from the book here, but I'm curious, just as a professional writer, what makes up like your days? You said you were doing a lot of traveling. Is that to give talks or?
Some writers are lucky enough, you know, in finances and in temperament to just make writing their life, and their day, you know, is just built around it. A lot of writers also do other things. And I run a literary center and edit a magazine that's published by the center. And so that's quite, you know, it's quite demanding. And I've been in service to a community, and I have a lot of obligations. So for the last 5 years, that, you know, the writing routine has had to, you know, work its way in a life that's pretty full.
Does that, when you said, you know, to the writers who like are, you know, have the fortune to have the money and the temperament to make writing,
yeah,
like a part of their everyday, like, is that, I don't know. How do you feel about that?
How do I feel about writers who get to do that?
And also about, going to this, and like when you say, oh, I have this busy life, there's almost, and maybe I'm mishearing it, but there's almost kind of like, a weariness.
This is something I think a lot about. I have always wanted to have to do community work. I've always wanted that to be a part of my life. And, you know, since I was in high school, I wanted to be a writer, and I wanted to be involved in things beyond my own byline. And, you know, my late 20s, I got involved with what was then a fledgling, super independent storytelling organization called The Moth, and The Moth has been a huge part of my life. And the other things I've done are not as famous as The Moth, but I've had many, many community projects as part of what I do. And it is hard to get the perfect balance. I mean, in this instance, I took a job that is extremely demanding and very rewarding. And yeah, it does get wearisome. And, you know, I'm now navigating the Institute through an extremely difficult time, you know. And work has been very hard, but also it's been unusually hard and unusually satisfying, I would say, because, you know, I'm part of a team that's making it, you know, that's stewarding through this pandemic, and yeah, I'm very proud to be part of it. And I'm also trying to do a lot. It's a lot to write a really ambitious reported book. And to do the job as well as I'd like to do it.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think that's got to be healthy, though, to be a part of a community. I mean, writing is a very solitary act, and the extent that you can get out and emerge in the world, and I think that's probably healthy. What was the one thing you just mentioned there? The Moth. What's your involvement with that?
My involvement now is that I had an historical role, and at times, I intersect, you know, with my colleagues who run the organization, and I'm supportive and sometimes collaborate with the organization. You know, I don't have a role on that. My role historically took a few names. I was a storyteller. I was a member of the board of advisors. I joined the board of directors. I curated shows. I played a role in concert with an incredible team of people. When I was on the board, I played a role in the inception of what became the Moth Radio Hour. And I just gave my heart and soul in a lot of ways. Years later, when I was applying for this job, I asked Catherine Burns, who's the artistic director, you know, could we come up with a phrase for me to put on my resume so that I could, you know, condense, you know, my involvement. And I can't remember who suggested founding advisor. I think I did, but she might have. They very generously offered me that phrase, the way of trying to summarize what I just told you. And I told a story. On the stage a while ago, and that was on the radio, and it's in their book now. And I have another story I'm developing. I'm involved in a variety of ways.
Yeah, no, I love The Moth. I mean, just the idea of random people getting up and telling stories, I think, is super powerful. But the
it's incredibly powerful, and it's an illustration of what I'm talking about in the book. That, you know, every time. The moth is a fascinating study in community and in a creative ecosystem. When you see a story on the main stage, that story is almost always the product of an extremely meticulous is not the right word. Thorough, often exhaustive, exhausting collaboration between the director of that story and the storyteller. And the aim of it is to create a story that just feels like the person is telling it at a dinner party. But most people can't do that. Most people can't get on stage and just do it. They need a lot of work. Eventually, the form of the Moth story was so nicely articulated by stories in the main stage that people started showing up at slams. They knew what they'd seen on stage, and they developed it. But even there, a lot of times what's most interesting in Moth Slam communities is that little circles emerge of practice and care where people essentially direct each other in a collaborative way. And when we do get to go back to being in public together and you go to a Moth Slam, you feel this palpable energy of congeniality and support, in part because like the people getting up, putting their names in the hat and getting up, have actually like they actually have really, really close storyteller friends in the audience. And it's a beautiful thing.
Well, why do you think it is that, is this just our culture in the West, maybe America in particular, or is this something that we've forgotten about the power of collaboration? Because we're always, you know, trained to look at just the individual and put one person on a pedestal, and it speaks to a not just an individualistic element of American society, but also kind of like an anti-society, you know, strain in the country as well.
There's a very particular history of it. Yeah, there's a very particular history about how we came to have the assumptions we have, and it's fascinating. I tell it a little bit in the book, and it's I elaborate a little bit in a piece I published in the New York Times. It was the title was I think it was the title was The End of Genius. But it's there's a very particular story. We're living in a particular time in history, and we might be at the end of it. Because the social science on loneliness and on networks, epidemiological understanding of not just of germs but of people, you know, the tipping point was Malcolm Gladwell's sort of summation and articulation of a body of social science that he encountered on the epidemiology of everyday life. The internet and the new economic models that arise from it, crowdfunding, for example. This is very significant. You have to understand where the lone genius myth came from. You have to go back to a time when there was a profoundly different economic system underneath all of creative expression. And this was the time of Shakespeare. Shakespeare is just a great way to sort of zero in on this pre-individualist obsessed moment. Because Shakespeare worked in a company, and the company was supported by a patron. And yeah, they made some money from ticket sales, but there was no publishing, and crucially there was no copyright. That's not how you didn't make your money, by writing a play and then owning that play and having it produced all over or read all over. You put on a play, and hopefully someone from the court was there or smiled on you, and you sold some tickets and you kept doing it. And then as the history progressed, you do see, and this is technologically driven, you do see that the need for copyright and an economic model of production that made that useful. And then the question is, okay, well, whose name is on this copyright? Like, who actually owns it? Oh yeah, I know you guys made it together. That's cool. That's all nice. But who owns it? Like, who am I sending the check to? Oh, I'm sending the check to two people. Well, who gets what percentage? All those questions, those did not come up in Shakespeare's time, but they did eventually. They did start. You know, Mark Rose wrote a definitive history of copyright, and you know, you could turn to authors and owners for a much more detailed and authoritative history. But this is the story in brief. And then alongside that came all this romantic individualist pap and all this mythology That, you know, post-war America is probably the absurd heights of it. We lost a sense of ourselves as connected beings, to the point where a lot of the social science that I'm sure you've read and that we now take as foundational, like John Cacioppo and his loneliness stuff, and Nicholas Christakis and his stuff around networks, with James Fowler, I think his partner. This stuff was laughed at in the 70s and 80s and even in the 90s. Like, we're in a really new place where we're beginning to understand scientifically the way that we're connected. And the internet and the models of the internet have played a major role. And what's going on with this pandemic is going to be profound, because it's articulating to so many people in a felt way what social scientists have been telling us for decades, that we're all interconnected. The decision I make when I hang up the phone with you is going to affect my ex-wife's partner's mother. Like, not in an abstract way, but in an extremely visceral way. I could actually lead to her death if I did the wrong thing right now. Because my son goes back and forth, and he could infect his mom could infect, and then next thing you know, his mother could be sick. I'm now carrying around a kind of visceral felt reality of that, but this is what Christakis and Fowler were telling us in their book years ago. It was harder for ordinary people to kind of conceptualize. It was more abstract. And now we're in this place like, wow, we're getting this. We're just getting bludgeoned with this lesson. Now, and then there's a counter reaction. You know, there are people who want to deny it, and they're freaking out. They're just freaking out because it's so challenging to them and the way they see the world. And so they're, screw it, they're flouting what the sensible world knows to be, the right action now.
Well, you know what the other weird thing is about this pandemic is that people, I see all these ads or posts like, we're all in this together. And I'm like, no, we're not. Like, there are people out there, I'm not saying we're not interconnected, but there are people who are having vastly different experiences of this than, you or I. There are people who,
yes,
are having much worse and much better. And there are people out there who are able to sort of just, we're all in this together, but weirdly, we're also, yes, extremely isolated, more isolated than we've ever been.
Yes.
So
That's true.
It's weird. I don't know how it's going to play out. I hope that it brings people closer together. But I can also see people just getting more and more hooked on their phones, on their computers, and when, the lights turn back on, people going, oh, well, we can just work from home now. Why are we wasting this money commuting? Right.
Well, yeah, some good things will come and some bad things. When I wrote my first book, Lincoln's Melancholy, I developed this adage. I don't think I ever put it in the book. Because people would say, oh, was it better in Lincoln's time or was it worse? And I came up with this adage in my mind that there's an absolute conservation of misery. Things were better in some ways. Things were worse in some ways. The same essential dynamics applied in a lot of ways. I think you're right. I think this time also highlights the possibility for disconnection. I think, we have to keep our eyes on the prize, which is finding this essential balance for creative lives, for our mental health, to build a decent and just and workable world where we attend to our individualist needs, and we also, tend to interconnection. And it's extremely difficult. It's always difficult. But the stakes are super heightened. They're really, really heightened right now, and it's stark. I feel it acutely, as we all do. And I think we're, you know, as you say, you know, many people are suffering really, really hard. And, you know, we're, of course, you know, we're a lot of the basic injustices of this world we've made have been exposed. And I mean, not that we didn't know that they were there, but they're just, you know, it's like someone said, I think AOC said it, you know, there's not a new fire, just pouring gasoline on it. And one thing that interests me in particular, and it's a book that I want to write, is about the particular kind of lie and romance of wealth that a lot of Western culture is enamored by, this mythos that you can buy your way into separateness and into a protected place. And yet, to some extent, I mean, it's not totally inaccurate, but it is in its most basic sense, it's a lie, and we're finding that out. We are interconnected, and we have to surrender to that reality, and then work within it, and work with its complexities and its contradictions.
Yeah,
but yeah.
Yeah, hey, no.
Listen, I have to tell you.
Go ahead.
I am really enjoying this conversation. I would be glad to continue, except I have a 2:00.
Hey, don't worry about it. Listen, I really enjoy talking to you. And please, anytime you want to chat again, you got another book coming out. Always happy to have you back on.
Well, listen, I appreciate you. You have a lot of presence. It felt like a real conversation. You're really, you know, you're clearly thinking on your feet. And you know, the podcast medium is sweet because it, you know, it opens space for exactly what you're doing. So it's a total pleasure. I haven't talked about this book in a while, and I definitely, you know, I got as honest with you as I could, and I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it, and appreciate the chance to talk to you very much.
I appreciate it. Thank you so much. And
okay, Duncan, be well.
Yeah, yes, you too.
I hope our paths cross again. Okay.
Absolutely. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you to Josh Schenck, and thank you for listening to Dunk Tank. I'm Duncan Gammy. See you next time.